Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things.
I walked in town on silver spurs, the jingle too, a song that I had only sang to just a few. She saw my silver spurs and said, let's pass some time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time, and I will give to you summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
And my lips, they could not speak. I tried to get up, but I couldn't find my feet. She reassured me with an unfamiliar line, and then she gave to me more summer wine. Oh, summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off your silver spurs and help me pass the time, and I will give to you summer wine. Mm, summer wine.
summer wine.
Strawberries, cherries, and an angel's kiss in spring. My summer wine is really made from all these things. Take off those silver spurs, help me pass the time, and I will give to you my summer wine. Oh, summer.
Thanks for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn. You're listening to Reciprocity Radio, and I'm Amanda, your host. This show is about food, cooking, eating, drinking, sharing, recipes, anything related to food culture, cuisine culture, and yeah. Thanks for tuning in. I'm sorry about the small amount of dead air at the beginning of the show. I am probably the sweatiest I've ever been right now, and I hope that's not too much information. But I went out to Coney Island or Brighton Beach today, and I thought, oh, I'll take the train back, no problem at all. I rode out on my bike, and I was like, I'll have time to take my bike home, and then I'll grab a car to go, no problem. I already had all my stuff with me for this show. It turned out that that did not happen. I had to ride my bike from Coney Island to here, and I was already pretty tired, and it's pretty hot out, so I almost fainted, but I made it, so... That's commitment, I think. What you heard when I first got in the station was Days of Wine and Roses sung by Ella Fitzgerald, and then Summer Wine by Nancy Sinatra. Hopefully that gives you a little clue to today's theme, which is going to be about wine, but about a particular wine. And it's that time of year. This show is going to be all about rosé. So I am a huge fan of rosé, and I think it's kind of funny because my family, and specifically my father, loves wine, and my parents go to Napa and Sonoma, and they buy from vineyards, and we have what is this called, like wine closets, and keep a lot of wine around the house, and it's always delicious, but they only buy reds. It's not delicious, it's always wonderful, but they mainly only buy reds, and occasionally if there's like a rosé, it's always just like a gift from the vineyard, and they don't really want it, and that's okay. But being my taste, I just really do love rosé, especially on summer. It's nice and cold and light. And so my dad has taken, I don't know, it's very sweet, but also very, I feel like it's sort of teasing me, sent me some articles in the mail about rosé wine that has appeared sort of in the New York Times and another from a different magazine. Not sure which one yet, but two about rosé. And I also got this book from him for Christmas, all about rosé. So I will be reading those today. It is Father's Day. So happy Father's Day to all dads out there, anyone with a dad, anyone without a parent, or to your caregiver, whoever provided or was there for you in life, or if you've lost a parent. I'm wishing you lots of love today, no matter what your situation is. So anyway, thanks for tuning in, and I'm sorry if I seem flustered. I knocked on the door in 100 Boger, and the guy looked at me like I was insane, because I'm covered in sand and also, like, grease from my bike, and I'm extremely pink from being sweaty, so pink to match today's theme. So yeah, I got two articles here and a book about the versatility of rose. The book I've read from the book before. If you go to reciprocityradio.com, you can find my archives. And on Valentine's Day, I did an episode about pink things and like romantic foods and aphrodisiacs and stuff. So I talked a little bit about rosé from this book, which is Drink Pink, A Celebration of Rosé from Victoria James, and illustrated by Lyle Rails back, and it's cute. It's not very long, but it has a pretty decent history. So on that show, I gave the history of this of the drink, and on this, this book sort of tells you all about why it is versatile. And then there's some really awesome. I see some quotes in here from various famous chefs. So I'm gonna get right into reading from this, and then we'll take another little music break with some wine theme songs. And right now we're hearing in the background, if you can hear it, it's Bill Evans playing a beautiful rendition of Wine and Roses, or The Days of Wine and Roses. So anyway, what I need right now is a nice cold glass of rosé. That's like the one thing that I need after that hectic ride and being very covered in dirt and sweaty. Anyway, this is from the book my father got for me. It's called The Versatility of Rosé. This is a chapter from there. Kermit Lynch once described rosé as red wine without tannins. Indeed, the drink can have a lot of aromatics, a lot of the aromatics and fruit of a good red. The difference is in the structure. Tannin in wine originates from the skins, seeds, and stems of grapes. It also comes from oak, so if the wine spends time in new barrels, it will have a bit of this extract as well. These two types of tannins are logically found in many reds, but not in rosés. Tannins also provide that drying effect in your mouth. With some foods, they are great, like fatty meats that need drying components to break through the richness in fats. With other foods, like oily fish, they're kind of a disaster. The tannins in the reds react with the oil to produce a bitter, almost metallic taste on the palate. So, when you want to avoid messiness that tannins can cause with some dishes, order pink wine. The grapes used for rosé are usually picked and a bit earlier than those destined for red, and they're sometimes whites. To preserve the freshness of the wine, the acidity. The freshness element, the refreshing element, is able to cut through fatty dishes and clean your palate. As a result, rosés are excellent along briny dishes like anchovies and oysters. Which, ugh, if you ever had oysters and a really good glass of wine, ugh, so good. So what separates rosés from whites? The texture and aromatics are what separates them. The bit of skin contact and color that is picked up in rosé allows for much more versatility in pairings. Winemaker Giampaolo Venica from Friuli, a region in northeast Italy, adds that rosé is perfect for traditional dishes where white wine just doesn't cut it, like in spring when white and green asparagus is in season. Serve with a sauce of boiled, crushed eggs and vinegar and the broadness of his Pinot Grigio, which has a bit of skin contact that picks up color, it is a perfect accompaniment for the dish. In Chinon, the town in Loire Valley, in France, asparagus is also paired with rosé. Winemaker Rodolphe Raffaut of Jean Maurice Raffaut gleams, "Often I serve for my friends cooked white asparagus, which is a spice with a spicy mayonnaise sauce, and that is paired with rosé." So that all sounds good. I think part of my absolute love for this wine is I was born in spring, and I think spring is my favorite season. So I love all the fresh vegetables that come out as soon as the season begins. And I love that rosé finally starts appearing in the wine shops because it's very fresh and beautiful. So here are some quotes I will read for you. This says, "Rosé all day and all year." I should also mention the inspiration for this show is it's not only things that my father sent me, which I love, but also my friend Dimitri yesterday had a housewarming party. He just moved down street from me, and the theme was rosé all day, and we just had everybody brought a bottle of rosé and we played board games, so it was really fun. And I was just with him. He was the one helping me get here from the beach when I was absolutely panicking, so thank you for being calm. I was not calm. Well, I owe you some more wine. Anyway, rosé all day all year. I was in a restaurant in New York about 3 years ago with my wife and 2 kids. With them, as is usual these days, everybody ordered something different. I thought, "Oh my God, let's have rosé." The sommelier said, "No, sorry, it's November. We don't offer rosé during the winter." I thought that was one of the oddest things I had ever heard. I had never imagined someone might think like that. One of the pleasures of rosé is that it would have gone well with everything that we'd ordered. And that's Kermit Lynch. So why do we think that rosé should be banned only to warmer months? Is it as silly as only drinking champagne for celebrations? Over time, we have come to associate rosé just with summer, and it is that about time we stopped. The beauty of rosé is its versatility, how it straddles the line between red and white. It is perfect pairing for many foods, especially like light ones like tapas or cocktail spreads or cheese boards, since those have lots of nice fatty things. And it's perfect, really, for all year long. So, Favorite Pairings by Chefs, Sommeliers, and Foodies. And this is where we get quotes from Jacques Pepin and Daniel Boulud and lots of other wonderful cooks and chefs. And this is for Jacques Pepin. In the summer, I will have friends over for an evening to play boule for dinner. And we will drink probably 110 bottles of wine, almost half a rosé. Cheese, salami, prosciutto, pate, and salad go well. All of those summer things, which honestly, if I had a choice, I'd live off that stuff. from Alice Waters, I drink it almost all throughout the meal. I drink it almost every day. For me, it just marries with all the food from Provence. Perhaps a fish soup or even something like a chicken with garlic. It's very adaptable. Let's see. From Daniel Boulud, I love the south of France and Mediterranean dishes, especially grilled summer vegetables with herbs, garlic, and spices. And rosé is always the perfect pair. And from another quote from Carmen Lynch, rosé works well with tapas like anchovies, anchovy toast, tapenade. Ugh, I love tapenade. But I never really think much about the perfect marriage, except with my wife, of course. If I'm in the mood for rosé, I'll drink it no matter what's on the plate. And from Jane Lopez, rosé is perfect with any kind of charcuterie. Cured meats, the saltiness of the meat is lifted and softened by the juicy fruits and the subtle grip of rosé. This is great. Yesterday I brought over a bunch of cheese and a bunch of salami for the party, and then we ordered pizza, so all we ate was cheese and meat, but it was really good, and some fresh cherries, because that's about the time of year. It ended up being absolutely delicious, so no regrets, and now I'm learning that maybe that wasn't the worst pairing. Let's see, who else is here? There's so many quotes that I'm trying to pick and choose. From Jeff Kruth, who is a master sommelier of the COO, or Guild of Sommeliers. While it might seem cliche, I really like to match rosé with foods with pink color, salmon, tuna tartare, seasonal tomatoes. Also, I find it's one of the few styles of wine that shines with eggs. Try a medium-bodied dry version with an herb and cheese frittata. I like this one guy who just wrote, Bruce Nyers wrote, and just this is it, sautéed calamari, which I don't eat cephalopods, but I understand the appeal. Let's see. Dustin Wilson, my favorite time to drink rosé is with my family, preferably during an outdoor crab feast in a down in Maryland. From Jeff Portner, rosé is my happy place any season, any time. It always makes me smile and enjoy life, and it's great with barbecue. And from Oliver Krug, for pairings, I like it when it is not classic. Don't hesitate to add a bit of wildness to the pairing. Play with spices. Let's see. I think this is why, and this is from Daniel Johns, who is the wine director of Daniel Boulud's Dynex group and founder of Le Pali in La Pali de New York. I love it with almost anything grilled with rosé, but my go-to favorite dish is grilled sausages, hot and sweet. So it is like, there is a reason it's great in summer. It's very light. It does pair well with these hearty foods that we like to grill, but also grilled fresh vegetables. I mean, I was just talking to my friend and I was like, if I had a grill, I would grill every single meal, every single day. It's like the best way to eat. Just simple meat and like vegetables with some nice vinaigrette. So good. When rosé begins to age a little bit, it can be married with a larger assortment of dishes. White meat, fish, shellfish, old cheese. My personal preference is for grilled lobster, and that's from Etienne Portalis. So there you go. Those are some really lovely quotes. This book is really great if you are actually into rosé and you want to have something cute to put on your table. This also has a lot of really funny rosé cocktails and looking through. Oh, and this is, there's, lots of things. Rosé sides and snacks. There are recipes to pair with the wine. So if you're looking for something really cute, oh, there's an olive tapenade, potatoes au gratin recipes. If you're looking for a cute book, I recommend it. Drink Pink, A Celebration of Rosé by Victoria James. Pretty cute and actually really informational. So that was from that. Thank you, Dad, for this gift, if you're listening. I'm going to cut to a little bit of music, and then we'll get to the articles. And yeah, I hope you're enjoying your day. Maybe you're having a nice glass of wine right now because it's a beautiful, about 83 degrees out, and there are no clouds in the sky. It's a great day in New York. Thanks for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn.
Myself on a cool damp night, gave myself in that misty light, was hypnotized by strange delight under a lilac tree. I made wine from the lilac tree, put my heart in its recipe. It makes me see what I want to see, be what I want to be. When I think more than I want to think, do things I never should do, I drink much more than I ought to drink, because it brings me back you. Steady, where's my love? everything so hazy? Isn't that he? Or am I going crazy, dear? Lilac wine, I feel I'm ready for my love. Feel I'm ready.
Welcome back. You're listening to Reciprocity Radio here on Radio Free Brooklyn. I'm your host, Amanda, and this is a show about food, cooking, drinking, eating, sharing, recipes, all of that fun stuff. Today's episode has been about rosé so far. And what you just heard was Lilac Wine by Nina Simone, or sung by Nina Simone, and before that was Sweet Cherry Wine by Tommy James and the Shondells. I'm going to read some articles because it's Father's Day. And because it's summer and we're finally having some nice hot weather here in June, finally feels like June here, I'm going to read a little bit about wine because my dad has sent me a couple articles about rosé. And I think this is this is funny and I like it. I think it's sort of making some fun of me, and that's fine. This is an article from, it's from the Wine Spectator from this year's issue from June 30th. This month's, I don't know how often this is published. But the most recent issue, and it is about the popularity of rosé. It's called Rosé's New Era, and it's by Mitch Frank. I'm going to read to you from this, because I'm slowly cooling down and not sweating, and I'm very sticky, sandy, and covered in bike grease here in the station. Apologies to whoever is next. Remember when rosé was out of fashion? That seemed ages ago when, on a sunny day this February, rock icon Jon Bon Jovi strode up the steps of the former Versace mansion in Miami to introduce his and son Jesse Bon Jovi's new rosé brand, made in partnership with Francis Gerard Bertrand. As the wine flowed, Bon Jovi treated guests to a brief concert, then took a selfie with all the empty bottles. The label, diving into Hampton Water, lives up to its billing, earning 90 points from Wine Spectator in a recent blind tasting. It joins a crowded shelf among star-powered rosés from Sophia by Francis Ford Coppola, Barrymore by Drew Barrymore, and the juggernaut of celebrity rosés, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie's Miraval, from vineyards at the Provence estate they jointly own. Or I guess they formerly jointly owned. These brands and many others testify that America is in love with pink. While overall wine sales have grown slowly in recent years, sales of dry rosés have boomed. According to Impact Databank, a publication of M. Schenken Community, the persistent decline of white Zinfandel and other sweeter blush wines resulted in a 1.8% dip in overall sales of rosé in the U.S. in 2016 to 17.2 million cases. But that decline obscures the strong growth of dry rosé. Sales of imported rosé, typically drier in style, grew 44%. So it seems as though we're all leaning to things that are less sweet, which is exactly to my taste. I prefer dry. In particular, imports of rosé from Provence doubled in 2016 to 1.27 million cases, according to Provence Wine Council. That's up to a whopping 4,852%. That's up 4,852% from 2001, when the U.S. imported just 17,500 cases. America is now consuming 20% of the global rosé supply each year, second only to France. Quality has risen as well. In 2007, when Wine Spectre published its last cover story on rosé, so that was 11 years ago they actually wrote about this, or made it a cover, our editors reviewed 135 still rosés, of which only one scored outstanding. In the past 12 months, they've reviewed 517 still rosés, with 39 rating 90 points or higher. For sparkling rosé, 88 were reviewed in 2007, and 36 of them were outstanding in 2017. Of 159 sparkling rosés reviewed, 86 are 90 points, so that's a lot more. That's 50 more, pretty much. That's great. Wow. Anyway, with all the distinctive rosé flowing, many wine drinkers are reaching for pink rather than red or white, even in the cool months. Rosé pairs well with numerous cuisines, and while there are some pricey bottles, it's easy to find quality for 20 or less, making the wines budget-friendly choices for everyday consumption. And I will pause here to make my own note. That is also why I like to buy it, especially like young wines that don't need a lot of aging. They don't cost as much. And while I do love all the wines that my family enjoys and purchases and keeps, I don't have the budget for a $45 to $100 or more dollar bottle of wine on a regular day to basis. But you can find very good rosé for under $20 or about $20 and still have a really quality drink. So that's one of the major selling points for me, and I'm sure for many young people out there. And rosé can be a lot of fun, as the article says, and its alluring hue is often packaged with eye-catching labels and creative bottle shapes. Market research firm Nielsen claims that 40% of rosé consumers are women aged 21 to 34. But the pink wine audience is broader in scope. Just search the hashtag brosé. The sense of ease around rosé is part of what's made its cultural phenomenon. The wine comes in forms of popsicle and rosé. Rosé-themed products include t-shirts like Rosé All Day, flip-flops, handbags, and more. Rydell now offers the Venom Extreme Rosé Provence glass, and in 2016, 12,000 rosé lovers swarmed Governor's Island in New York Harbor for a pink-nick, dressing up in pink and white and enjoying lunch and plenty of rosé on the glass. The event was organized by Pierrick Bouquet, a Frenchman who has also launched America's first rosé and food festival, La Nuit en Rose. But wine drinkers with long memories have seen this before. Americans eagerly drink Matera's and Lancer's off-dry rosés from Portugal in the post-year wars, and in the 1970s and 80s, California's white Chimandel and offshoot Blush, and its offshoot Blush wine of white Blush White Chimandel, boomed. Is this the current rosé trend? The entry to a new era of wine where we recognize three separate but equal shades? Red, white, and pink, or are we simply on the ascent side of another cycle and boom for the category? I want to find this, because Dimitri has asked me to go to this. There is like a rosé mansion. There's something happening in July here in New York where a rosé mansion is opening in NYC this summer, and it's going to be ridiculous. There is a whole, they're going to turn a townhouse or something uptown into a rosé mansion where you will go through and you pay like things like $40 and you get to spend 2 hours and taste wines from various regions and different makers, different colors, and all there's like an experience and like a bunch of really Instagrammable stuff. It's gonna be really pink. I know we're gonna try that out when it opens in July, so look for a rosé mansion. I'm sure that'll be something good for your Instagram if you're into that kind of thing. Anyway, I'll continue with this article. There has always been pink wine. In the ancient days of winemaking, the reason was simple. People aren't that good at making red wine. Early wine was made by stomping red and white grapes together, then allowing the juice to drain into containers and ferment. Skin contact was usually minimal, and the resulting wine was a cloudy rosé. The Greeks and Romans eventually began to separate grapes by color, but even then, skin contact for most wines was brief. When the English fell in love with the wines of Bordeaux in the late 16th century, the wines were light red, almost pink wines that were clear and fresh. Claret comes from the Latin word for clarity. But in the century that followed, technical advances in glass and cork production meant wine could be aged reliably. Europeans learned that wine could grow complex and evocative as it aged, especially if it was dark and tannic. Rosé remains, but in many regions it became a byproduct of red winemaking, and that through the technique of I'm so sorry. I have no knowledge of French, so sometimes I struggle on this show. Through the technique of Sanji, what did I lose off? Oh, in which juice is bled from the tanks of red wine during the early hours of maceration in order to concentrate the juice left behind. Rosé, as an afterthought, the quality of most of that reflected it, that it was such a thing. An afterthought. But in some regions, rosé maintained a distinct identity, particularly in Mediterranean terroirs like Spain, Italy, and especially Provence. The limestone hills and hot summer days of Provence produce red grapes ideal for rosé production, and the climate in Provence's small hillside villages demands that locals have light, fresh wine to drink during the long summers. In America, rosé made its first splash with Matures and Lancers. Both arrived immediately after World War II, at a time when returning GIs were looking for European wine. The wines were lightly sparkling, and versions made for the export market were slightly sweet, a wine introduction for Coca-Cola palates of the, I guess, post-World War II times. In 1978, Matures accounted for over 40% of Portugal's total table wine exports, with the worldwide sales approaching 3.5 million cases a year. Eventually, America made a signature rosé. Beginning in 1972, Bob Trinchero began bleeding off juice from his California Zinfandel. The resulting Sanji failed to sell, but in 1975, a stuck fermentation left it sweet. That vintage chilled out. For 11 years, the white Zinfandel was the number one varietal in the United States. The wine, its copycat, and its copycats provided an introduction to the joys of wine for millions of Americans. But it also conditions American consumers to think, to see pink and think sweet. Thus, when wine drinkers moved on to Chardonnay and Cabernet, they left behind rosé. The recent revival of rosé's fortunes took even experienced vintners by surprise. Albert de Villiers of Domaine de la Romanée Conti, I'm so sorry, in Burgundy, partnered with Jacques Cessé of Domaine du Jacques and another friend in 1989 to establish Trans, an estate in South of Provence. Their goal, Jacques Saint-Jeremy Cessé says, was red wine. Rosé was absolutely not a priority. Average quality in Provence was pretty mediocre anyway, and demand was local with very low prices. It was hard to conceive that this would become our workhorse one day. But sales of Provence rosé began to rise in France, and in the late 1990s, largely driven by women. In response, Provence wine associations invested in improving quality. He also began to market the rosés aggressively overseas, especially in America, with the message that French rosé, unlike white sin, was a dry wine, so not cloyingly sweet. Some sommeliers and retailers began to put rosés on wine lists and store shelves. Sales increased, though rosé remained a seasonal wine. In 2006, Sacha Lynching decided that rosé could demand respect. Lynchin, son of the late wine importer and Bordeaux Chateau owner Alexis Lichin, had sold off their Chateau Prior Lichin 7 years earlier and wanted to build his own identity in the south of France. Using ceremony, Lichin bought Chateau d'Esclans and the Côte de Provence, and he launched his brand with three different cuvées. Lichin and his partner Patrick Lyon invested heavily in viticulture and modern winemaking, even partially fermenting some lots in oak barrels. The Esclans priced its flagship wine at more than $100 a bottle. It was blasphemy, and soon even ultra-wealthy yacht owner and Saint... ultra-wealthy... Soon every ultra... This is a weird turn of phrase. Every yacht owner in Saint-Tropez wanted to have it. And while Garus, the wine that was $100 a bottle, grabbed headlines, Lichin's entry-level rosé, Whispering Angel, which flaunted an edgy label and a bold but unmistakably Provençal flavor, became the bestseller at $22 a bottle. You can find that everywhere. I've seen that all over the place. I've always kind of side-eyed the name. The name is a little strange, but whatever. Chateau d'Esclans made 10,000 cases of Whispering Angel in 2006, and by 2016, so 10 years later, production was up to 360,000 cases, with more than 200,000 of them shipping to the U.S. In New York Hamptons, Lichin had a competition from a local startup, Germany-born venture capitalist Christian Wolfer. Oh, sorry, I have to flip the page here. Had this is a very long article. I might have to cut it short so I can read the rest of them. Had found a wolf fur estate. I've also tried this wine in 1982 with the goal of producing red and white tannins. He achieved modern success planting extensive vineyards and hiring talented German winemaker Roman Ruff. Rosé was not a major focus, but in 1992 he made 82 cases of rosé. We made dry rosé, and at the time, rosé had to be sweet or it had to be French, and we were neither. When Wolfer died in 2008, the estate was making 4,000 cases of rosé annually. His children saw potential in that wine. Last year, Roth made 60,000 cases of it, almost 75% of the winery's overall production. Wolfer Estate now makes 3 cuvées, one called Summer in a Bottle, which comes in a bottle vividly painted with an explosive garden of fruits and flowers. It's a label that encapsulates rosé's appeal in America, answering the complicated question of wine with one simple rule: drink this and enjoy. Yet while Wolfer grabs a nice share of its local market, it was Provence that took the rosé mainstream across America. An increasing number of brands follow Nation's lead, having focused on red wines for 20 years. Trianon shipped 4,500 cases of rosé to the U.S. in 2010, but last year it was 20,000. I don't know how to read this name. It's S-E-Y-S-S-E-S. Credits several factors from the boom. There have been huge improvements in quality. The White Zinfandel generation was waning, and along with it, the stigma of being a pink wine. And millennials are less intimidated by wine than the previous generations. They are willing to try all styles, from skin contact whites to oxidative styles of wine to rosés, or pretty much anything out there. Just willing to try rosé was huge. It proved to be likable. They also believe the financial crisis forced people to look for an affordable luxury, and that rosé fit the bill really well, both fashionable and delicious without being overly pricey. Of course, it never hurts to have star power. In 2012, Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie bought the Côte de Provence estate that it had been running for a few years, Château Miravel. They formed a partnership with the Perrin family, owners of Château de Beaucastel, and then they made the Miravel Rosé. That 2012 earned 90 points on a spot of Wine Spectre's 2013 Top 100. What made Provence Provence is that it did not see rosé as an afterthought. We believed if you made the right decisions, if you chose the right clones and picked up at the right time and treated it carefully in the cellar, you could evaluate the reputation of rosé. Today, between Miravel and the family Perrin brand La Vieille Ferne, the Perrins are making 500,000 cases of rosé a year. The growth has doubled in digits every year, says Perrin. But the rosé boom faces two major risks: saturation and homogenization. As sales growth lures more and more wines into the market, and as most of them mimic the Provençal style of their quickest path to success, industry insiders worry that rosé is turning from a category wine into a whole brand. It seemed like in the past 18 months, the market has got ahead of itself with rosé, says David Bowman, executive vice president of marketing for Jackson Family Wines. Look at the store shelves. There's a lot of lower priced stuff that has not sold through, and a lot of those are big commercial brands that sell their rosé for $8 or $10. They all thought they would be first in the category, and now they see that it's crowded. The Jackson family has increased its rosé production in recent years as well. This year, Bowman expects to sell a combined 50,000 cases of rosé under the company's Kendall Jackson and La Crema labels, both made from Monterey Pinot Noir, as well as small amounts of rosé from Copan and Sonoma and Grand Moraine in Oregon. He argues there's a big quality difference between rosé above and below the $10 mark, and I am actually really inclined to agree with that, although occasionally you find a cheap one that is really quite surprising. While the numbers of rosé on our store shelves has grown, the diversity of character, style, and flavor has shrunk. One of rosé's virtues has been its variety. Partly due to its deep roots in the many local regions, it has been made from indigenous grapes with traditional methods. As a result, rosé comes in all shades and flavors, from Provençal Salut to Hors d'oeuvre to Spanish Garnacha to Italian Negro Amaro to California Pinot Noir. But since Provence has become king, everyone has moved to follow its example. Most of the low-cost rosés share Provence's pale pink hue, its flavor profile, but with a bit more sweetness. It has to be pale pink to sell, says one importer, which, that's sad. I know people that really don't prefer that. I do enjoy it, but I know lots of people who don't. I'd rather a deeper color in the grape. Wineries in other regions have taken note. Bodega Muga in Spain, Rioja has made a gorgeous salmon-colored rosado for decades from traditional blend of Garnacha, Viura, and Tempranillo. Last year, Muga added a new wine to the line, Flor de Muga, a pale pink 100% Garnacha with a flower on the label. Other Spanish wineries have been following suit, producing their traditional rosados from local markets, but also making Provençal-style for export. Massi, the famed Mamaroni producer, makes the rosé from Frueli grapes. A few years ago, the winery began aiming for a lighter style. For us to have any success to the U.S. market, it has to have that Côte de Provence color, says Tony Apostolakos, director and for the Americas. Probably the most worrisome trend we are seeing is the homogenization of styles across a wide range of appellations toward a pale, very delicate, citrus-scented rosé. This is all to meet a certain market expectation. So that's just, wow, it's a lot of information, and I'm almost running out of time. Oh man, I intended to read both of these articles to you, but this is such a great in-depth article, and again, it's from Wine Spectator. Wow, and there's still like almost a full page here. I will just read the last paragraph for you, and I hope you'll go check out Wine Spectator. I'm sure they have a wonderful website, and you can probably get this subscription, and it's, yeah, this is wonderful. I'm learning a lot. I actually want to learn more, and it was well-written and easy to digest. So, from the very end of this article, top rosé producers agree that rosé wine should be its own goal, not just a byproduct of red wine production. That means grapes are picked earlier for freshness. Juice isn't the blend off of tanks of natural red wine. Instead, it's gently macerated for enough time to draw the ideal amount of flavor and then quickly removed to ferment. Jake Bilbro is the proprietor of family-owned Limerick Lane Wines in Sonoma's Russian River Valley. His father was a Sonoma pioneer, founding Marietta Cellars in 1978. Bilbro picks the Syrah for his rosés at lower ripeness when the express purpose is creating a fresh, vibrant wine. If you choose to bleed your tanks to make your rosé, that wine is an afterthought, he says. If you're choosing to pick your grapes at a lower Brie and make rosé, that is forethought. He would make a red Syrah and sell it for more money, but instead he is making an orange-colored rosé. A great rosé is a beautiful thing, he says. And this is the kind of rosé Sonoma Syrah makes. He sells most of his 800 cases of rosé made from Russian River Valley Syrah direct to consumer because he finds wholesalers are not interested in a dark rosé priced at $26 a bottle, and that's fine with him. Rosé is wine's rockstar at the moment, hoping not to become a one-hit wonder. If it continues to sing new songs, it will always have loyal fans. So thank you again for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This has been Reciprocity Radio. Thank you to my dad, and happy Father's Day for sending me these articles. I did do research. I had some more things, and we just ran out of time here. But I'll link all the things that I researched and used for this episode on reciprocityradio.com. You can find all my sources there. I'll throw up some fun recipes, maybe some wine reviews, because I tried lots of the ones that we have mentioned here on the show. And I hope you're having a beautiful Sunday. Go out there and drink a glass of wine in the open air, and enjoy this beautiful weather. Thanks so much for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. I hope you will check out our website, radiofreebrooklyn.org. We are a nonprofit, so if you like what you hear anytime on the radio, think about giving us a donation. Anything helps, anything counts. When we love to keep it going here, so thanks for tuning in. I'm going to take us out with Emmy Lou Harris with two more bottles of wine. I'll see you next Sunday at 5 p.m. right here on Radio Free Brooklyn.